Hi, Derek Stewart McPherson here. Welcome to Ungagged. And I'm here with Councillor Graham Campbell from the Glasgow Council. So how are you, Graham, today?
I'm very well.
Thanks for joining us. Now, I can't help but notice that I've walked in on you and clearly in the middle of an election campaign.
You have indeed.
So how's it going?
We're speaking for the nerve centre of Amit Lachlan's campaign for Glasgow North East, and we're in the middle of spring brand in a Andrew Carnegie-built former library, which is being brought into community use by, first of all, by us using it as a campaign room, but hopefully will be followed after the election by community groups using this place and the brilliant space that we've got here. Springman lacks a lot of things after 40 years of neglect
of course,
Labour Party letting everything fall down to ruin. So when I came in 2 years ago along with my colleagues, one of the things we pledged to do was get community facilities and empowerment up and running and try and demolish some important buildings. One of them was this Talisman, which is an old pub. So today's Evening Times got our story where we've worked with the community council members, with local allotment users, local residents in that area. We've got a derelict building which has been burnt down 25 years ago and has not been demolished because it's privately owned and the Labour Council has left it there. And so the poor folks in Springman have to look at this dreadful burnt out husk of a building which council hasn't used its powers to bring down. So I spent 2 years campaigning to get the council to bring that building down, and finally yesterday we were able to say we're going to push ahead a compulsory purchase order to make it happen.
Just yesterday, so there we go.
It's in today's paper.
It's today's paper. We're right on the cutting edge of breaking stories here. So what's that building called?
That's the Talisman.
The Talisman. So that's finally going to be...
Think the Klansman in Steel Game, but burnt down, and you know...
So, yeah, because I noticed coming in here, this is obviously the old library, and it's on a rather large square that's now a car park. I guess this must have been the centre of Springburn at one time. It was only yards from the station.
Well, the thing is that the way they've Springburn was really destroyed by building the A803 right through the middle of it, and 80% of the town centre's buildings and shops were destroyed to make it happen. So any place that's had that kind of loss to it is going to struggle to recover from that. And Springburn has gradually, bit by bit, lost its industries and workplaces and shops, and it's been left with what's left. And so we're trying to come back from there, a bit like your experience at Clive Bank, I suppose. Whereas in your case, it was done by the Germans. In our case, it was done by our own council.
Well, part of it was done by the Germans. And then there was in the late 70s, there was actually a lot of demolition done by the council as well, because that's when they decided to move the centre of town, basically demolish the centre of town, build a road through it, again similar. They wanted to widen the road, and then they discovered when they demolished the entire high street almost to widen the road that the demand for the road wasn't there anymore, because there was nowhere to go. But then they built the new shopping centre, the Clyde Shopping Centre, which everyone's heard of, but it's not a town centre.
So as a banker, you understand our experience.
I do. I feel you've been there. Very much so.
So, very important stuff that we've managed to at least, we're doing quite a lot of, Anne as a candidate has been very keen on sort of community empowerment, community engagement, community development. So that's been a central theme of the campaign. We're trying to deal with the one remaining Labour MP who won the seat off her 2 years ago.
2017, right.
And the difficulty there, we lost that seat by just 242 votes. I mean, Anne had won it with a record swing in 2015, and people probably didn't think that we could lose it. And a lot of our voters stayed at home or were a bit complacent. Even our activists were a bit complacent 2 years ago.
Yeah, you do get that.
So we're not going to be so complacent this time. Polling is going well. There's evidence on the door that there's a massive shift because of Brexit of Labour Remainers voters. They are shifting towards independence, and if they vote Remain and pro-independence, we're the only candidates that stand for that. So I think there's a decisive shift towards more support for independence, and thus more support for us at the ballot box this time.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that, because I have noticed some tendency towards that, and particularly, as you say, the Labour Remain voters coming around to the idea of independence as well in the polls. So you're seeing that on the ground.
Oh yeah, definitely. Doorstep is picking that up, and consistently. I mean, one of the important changes, I suppose, since 2016 in particular, but also to partly since 2014, is obviously politics in Scotland has polarised between yes parties and no parties.
Mm.
And interestingly, the no vote swung behind the Conservatives 2 years ago, which is why they won lots of seats.
Mm.
So Conservatives are seen as more of a no party, and that wouldn't be possible if it wasn't one phenomenon which you may have noticed, was that in the past, I would have canvassed people door-to-door, and you'd ask people, what's their first-choice party? Usually, SNP person would say, oh, what's your second choice? Be Labour. A Labour voter would say their second choice would be SNP.
Yeah.
That's changed now. SNP voters don't give Labour as their second choice, and Labour voters, many more of them than ever before, give Tory as their second choice.
Interesting, isn't it?
Which is incredible. I mean, especially here in Springburn, of all places, for a Labour voter to even think about giving Tories their second preference, that shows you why their vote increased in 2017. Labour no voters switched to Tories. So that's something that I've never seen before. In all the years I've campaigned here in Springfield, 15 years in elections, never seen that.
No, that's certainly something new. I mean, those two parties were polar opposites, and as far as the support went, people would never consider going from Labour to Tory or Tory to Labour. But now it seems that that's a tactical option.
Yeah, and so obviously SNP voters have tended either to not have a second party, or they might vote for the Greens in a proportional election. So the Greens did quite well in 2017's council elections because of that. SNP voters lending them their votes. So.
Yeah.
But it's pretty clear now that the polarisation between yes and no is a continuing trend, and obviously we've been the beneficiaries of that in electoral support and obviously in membership and activists, so we obviously can put more activists on the ground than anybody else at the moment.
Having the highest membership. The membership's still
pretty high. I don't know what it exactly high, is. Obviously, we haven't got all the people we had in 2015, but we've certainly got well over 120,000 designs, as far as I know.
Right, wow. Yeah,
which makes us proportionately the biggest party in the British Isles.
Oh, easily, yeah. That would be... I suppose the Corbyn move with the cheap membership, you know, the £1 memberships or whatever it was that he brought in, did increase their membership a bit, so they looked better, because they were actually in danger, I think, of being overtaken by the SNP at one stage. But now, on Corbyn, while I mentioned that, I mean, there's been a lot of talk over the last few days. We've had the Labour manifesto released. It seems quite radical. It's got a lot of big spending proposals in it, and a lot of things like renationalisations. Now, you're representing the left in the SNP. What's the feeling about the Corbyn manifesto? Is it something that's gonna work for Labour, or is it something that we could be looking at and saying, well, maybe we should just
Many of the things in it are already SNP policies that we've been carrying out. I mean, we don't have to renationalise some of the utilities. We didn't privatise them in the first place. We have water that's publicly owned. SNP's long been in favour of renationalisation of rail and re-regulation of bus routes, but its Labour government was in power for 13 years, having controlling all three branches of government.
Conspicuously didn't
and
do
didn't
that,
do yeah. that. And they were in office. So, you know, we've committed ourselves to things like nationalising shipyards when they were threatened with closure, BIFAB, which is a wind farm turbine manufacturer. So we saved those from complete closure because we want to keep an industrial base in Scotland. So we've acted as a government. We are considered the most competent government across these islands, because you've got a decent leader and a decent manifesto and a decent, you know, carrying out of policies that are in the interests of working class people. People know that. You know, that's why the NHS here is better than anywhere else in the UK. We don't have anything like the waiting times and shortages of doctors and nurses. We have more doctors and nurses than we've ever had before. So, you know, there's more money been spent on the health service in Scotland than ever before. We also have no tuition fees. SNP's been implementing that for 12 years. So they were putting in its manifesto, oh, they're going to abolish tuition fees now, when it was them that brought the tuition fees in the first place.
It was, wasn't it?
So it may sound radical for England, but it's not very radical given what's already been mainstream commonplace policy in practice by the SNP government. It's not that radical. Now, of course, some of that old-time religion is designed to appeal to both older voters who have a vague memory of working class solidarity, but it's also trying to appeal to a younger generation that perhaps, obviously, they're young enough to only know the SNP in government. If you're 20 years old, you've only ever known an SNP government in Scotland. So you could understand why there may be a shift or lack of understanding of what happened before, because you won't remember it.
But I have noticed that there's a lot of young people or students that have been interviewed on TV in the last week or so who have been quite attracted to Labour, and you get the feeling they don't remember. They're only sort of 18 to 22 or whatever. Then how much can they remember? It's only back to the noughties, I suppose.
They won't remember what Blair and Brown's government was like when the country was very wealthy, when the super rich were indulged, when neoliberalism was let loose, and when we still had austerity. We just didn't have the budget cuts. And despite not having the budget cuts, Scotland didn't recover from its deindustrialisation under their control. And councils were still strapped for cash, things still fell apart. And then when the recession came in 2007-08, they started the austerity, and the Tories just took the ball and ran with it when they came into office. So people need to remember that it started under Labour. And when we came into government, much of our policies have had to mitigate against what the central government did. So we stopped people from having to pay the bedroom tax. We've campaigned against all the negative things like the rape clause and so on. We tried to put in a benefit system of our own, which is different and more progressive. So where we've had the power, we have used it to create progressive taxation. We've done that. So I think what we can argue strongly is that we've got a strongly left of centre social democratic government, which has acted in the interest of working people. And also on big political questions that socialists care about, which is nuclear weapons, Trident, war. SNP MPs have voted consistently against all of those. Ironically, usually along with Jeremy Corbyn, when he's rebelling his 500 times against Blair and Brown, he was voting with us. And they when he was in Parliament as the before he was leader, he was one of about eight, him and John McDonnell, who of Labour left MPs who were completely marginalised by their own parliamentary group. Yeah. And they used to vote with the SNP because they were their mates in Parliament. So if anything, the ones he can rely on more than anybody are probably the SNP MPs to vote the same way as him. So he can't rely on the ones behind him who are being re-elected just now, pretending they're socialists, including the one in this seat. People don't know this, but Sweeney was one of 200 Labour members who signed a petition to tell Corbyn to resign in 2015.
Right. So can I ask, I met Jeremy Corbyn once when I was very young, 1983. Mm. But you actually knew him reasonably well because you were in his constituency
I'm from Islington.
In Islington. So let me ask you this one. What is it that Jeremy Corbyn doesn't get about Scotland?
He's English.
Yes.
And as a lot of English liberal lefties of that type and generation, you get very passionate about revolutions everywhere else in the planet, whether it's Vietnam, Africa, Latin America, and you're for revolutions everywhere except in your own country or in the bounds of your own state. And this is the test for me of a socialist internationalist, is are you against your own state? Now, on the Irish question, Jeremy has actually been consistently in support of unified Ireland.
Yes.
But not been in favour of the self-determination of Scotland or Wales.
Which seems to me to be an extremely contradictory position.
Of course it is, but it's always been that imperialist blind spot that the English left has always had, and indeed many of the Scottish left, the Unionist Scottish left, have had. And it's a lack of understanding that the most radical thing you can do is not take over the UK state and try to make the UK state act socialistly. You need to break up the UK state and dismantle the Westminster corrupt power structure, and therefore make it possible for ordinary people to take control of their lives and have more power as against the state. That's why I want an independent Scotland, because I think we've got a better chance of creating a more equal society, a more socialist society, because I fancy our chances against our ruling class, put it that way.
Yes, I'd have to agree with that. I mean, to me, it looks like the UK was set up in order to protect England's back door as it built its empire. So it's really an artefact of imperialism. And in order to complete the decolonization process, it has to go, doesn't it?
Yes. I always say this. I've said this twice at party conference, but Babylon must fall. Empire must actually fall, because it's an incomplete process. Absolutely, incomplete process, I should say. Until that empire state is actually dismantled, the English people, never mind everybody else on these islands, won't be properly free. What the English people need, and I can say this as a Londoner, they need regional devolution the way they've got it in Germany or France, where power is not concentrated in Westminster. They need a democratic revolution to do that. But that will only come with Scotland breaking away with its democratic revolution, which is independence. Our movement is a democratic revolutionary movement, designed to break down one of the world's main imperialist powers and bulwark for the financial oligarchy that runs the planet and is destroying it. It's really crucially important in international politics that we achieve independence, never mind for the ordinary working class people around Springburn. If they want a hope of a different kind of future, we need to break the British state. And that is the most radical thing we can do.
Yeah, that's very well put. I have to agree with you entirely on that. Now, as we're engaged in that process, and obviously we're in the middle of the Brexit election. Now, this is just a huge subject, I suppose, to open up. But you were alluding earlier on to the fact that that this has changed things for the independence movement in Scotland. Now, what do you think is the most likely outcome of this election in terms of Brexit? Will Brexit happen? Would you care to hazard a prediction there?
I've been predicting since last year that there would be a general election this year. And I confidently predicted that because I knew that Boris Johnson, if he became leader, would always have a Brexit election, because he would fancy his chance. He would have the hubris to think that he could beat Corbyn, he could portray him as a revolutionary Marxist disruptor of capitalism, and also an incompetent leader. Both of which are half true.
You know who I last heard saying that? In Australia, Alistair Campbell. I posted a couple of YouTube clips that I'd recorded myself because I couldn't believe what he was saying.
Oh, well, that's what those people believe. They're daft. But the irony is, though, of course, is that on Brexit, we agree with Campbell on what he says about Brexit.
Well, yes, and he said Boris Johnson will definitely be arrogant enough to think he can win an election, and he will go for one. And he predicted a hung parliament, a second independence referendum, which we will win this time.
Well, I didn't know he said that.
He did, yeah.
Well, no, I
don't think he said it here. This is what he said when he was out in Australia a few months ago.
Yeah. He can see it coming, and anybody that can see that, you know, we said that in 2016 when we ran for the Holyrood elections as a government, that if the circumstances changed, which Brexit was the obvious one, and if Scotland was taken out of the EU by against our will, we would have a mandate to call another referendum. So we've had a mandate.
Now, what was the one? It was a significant material change in circumstances.
Significant material change in circumstances, which this clearly is. Nobody voted for this.
Yes, no. Certainly, I don't think anyone in Scotland voted for this. It's part of a worldwide trend, really, though, isn't it? Of burn it all down politics.
And you could understand where that's coming from. You've had a mainstream consensus for 40 years around neoliberalism, which basically treats the rich and basically taxes the poor to the pipsqueaks to give them more wealth. And that's been going on for a long time. We've had a recovery from this terrible recession from 10 years ago where the confidence in the capitalist system was shaken. But the lessons that many people, particularly in England, learnt from that wasn't to blame the ultra-capitalists, but to blame sections of the poor ourselves, to blame us for being indolent or undeserving. The Tory narrative about that was successful because the propaganda machine kicked in and said, oh, Labour emptied the cupboards and it's their irresponsibility that created the crash. No, it's the capitalists' irresponsibility and us having to bail them out and their banks that's making us poor. So they've got away with that argument for 10 years. And so then the ultimate impact of that is Brexit. Brexit is the classic act of political self-harm. Because it's people who are angry and frustrated about how they have been treated by capitalism, but then listening to the siren voices of the most hardcore right-wing capitalists in the establishment,
yeah,
and going with their strategy to deal with that, which is to actually make it worse. Mm. More neoliberalism, not less. But at last, one thing you can say about the campaign we are talking about here is we're trying to fight this as an anti-austerity election. Both Labour and SNP are trying to do it, to some mm-hmm. extent the Greens as well. Clearly, that we are well to the left in Scottish political culture, and we have been for some time, as to where England has been, and we have been diverging. And because we're diverging, independence is clearly inevitable. And obviously, even people who don't want it recognise that's the case.
I've certainly that's certainly been my impression, is that even those who are not in favour are seeing that inevitability now, and it's we have become a separate polity, and I think. There's an argument that we always were to an extent, but while we had the same parties operating here and being dominant here, you could see it as a single body politic. It's very hard to see it that way now, especially when your unionist parties, your Labour, Conservative and Lib Dems are basically fighting over crumbs.
But it's worse, it's more important now, because if Johnson get, you know, I'd have predicted the possibility of a UKIPisation of the Tory party, and we've kind of got that in the form of the Brexit partyisation of the Tory party. But yeah, essentially, the Tory party is running on what the Brexit campaign stood for. Dominic Cummings running it; it's his politics, it's his manifesto. So it's not the Tory party as we knew it. Mm. It is like the invasion of the body snatchers in a political party. Mm. They have colonised it. And a similar process happened. I lived in Canada briefly during the 90s, and a similar process happened to the Conservatives over there. Mm. A right-wing anti-NAFTA party called Reform kicked off in the western provinces of Canada, where previously there had been social democratic governments. They took over, became ultra-right-wing neoliberals and basically displaced the traditional moderate Conservative Party and eventually took them over and merged with them. And that is the current Conservative Party in Canada. Right. So I predicted that was quite a possibility here. And effectively we've got that by the Brexitisation of the Tory Party.
Mm.
So that's a different kettle of fish.
Yes, it does remind me of something that was happening in Australia earlier this year, because, you know, as a dual national, this is actually going to be my second general election this year. I had one in Australia. I think it was May, or it was around then. Anyway, what they had was they had a guy called Clive Palmer, who used to be part of the Conservative parties over there. They're not called Conservatives, they're called
National and Liberal.
National and Liberal, or the Coalition, together. He used to be a part of that. He broke away and set up a sort of populist party, which, you know, it's, the similarities to UKIP and Brexit are quite strong. In the end, he won no seats, but he's a billionaire and he spent an awful lot of money on advertising, and he probably deprived the Australian Labour Party of a number of key important seats in Queensland, particularly. And it looks as though the Brexit Party is going to fulfil a similar role, or at least attempt to, in that they won't take any seats themselves, but they may well harm the Labour Party in some of the Northern English seats.
Well, that moves neatly on to why the confused Brexit position of Corbyn has borne fruit here, because if Labour had a consistent Remain policy this last couple of years, then we wouldn't be talking about their possibility of losing their seats in England. It wouldn't be an issue, because there would be no chance of it.
Yeah.
But the lack of a clarity, and you can understand why, from one point of view perspective, why Corbyn is sceptical, because he's always been a Eurosceptic. But to be fair, I've known him for 30 years, so I've known that he's always been a critical sceptic, but he's always been for Remain and Reform. He was with it as long as there was a socialist, as in socialist parties in Europe, direction to where Europe was going. And at the time of Jacques Delors, that was a possibility in progressive social legislation, the social Europe. He was in favour of that stuff. He just wasn't in favour of the neoliberal capitalist bit. But the neoliberal capitalist bit comes from the fact that right-wing governments are winning the elections and to the governments. And as long as right-wing governments still keep being elected, Europe will be right of centre. We need to have a people's Europe where the left of centre parties and governments get their act together and put a prospectus about Europe, which is progressive, internationalist, open borders, freedom of movement, you know, with that kind of perspective, which is anti-austerity, anti-neoliberal, saves the planet. That's the kind of perspective that left parties will succeed in changing the European project. When you deal with it only as a nationalist, which ultimately, and I mean this in the British nationalist sense, if you deal with it at the British state nationalist level, you can't possibly have an internationalist policy. And that's why he's equivocating on Brexit, because he can't not relate to the Brexit voting section of his voters, which aren't as much as people say. You know, two-thirds of Labour voters voted Remain.
Yes, and I think there's a Remain majority in every Labour seat.
Yes, so it's not a question that Labour has all these Leave-voting voters who would have otherwise not, voted for Labour. No, he'll probably keep two-thirds of his voters, but that will be not enough to keep all of his seats. Yeah. So the chances of him winning this general election, I think everybody knows that's hard. And Boris Johnson has lined up the 40% of the population that actively supports Brexit, and they're going to go behind him. That 40%, which is very actively Remain, is split between about five parties.
That's a problem, isn't it? It's always going to be a difficult one to overcome. But having said that, looking at the seats that Boris Johnson would actually have to win, I'm not sure I can see a way that he can get there. He'd be looking at seats in the north of England the Tories have never ever won before. So that would be a major shift in the political ground. Particularly in the north.
It's certainly going to go that direction. I think there will be some close shaves and they may even pick up one or two. But I think it's pretty clear that Jeremy Corbyn can't win a majority. And I think it's pretty clear that there's a good chance that Boris won't. Right? I think the more likely result is what we have now, the hung parliament. The question is, how hung is it? How many SNP MPs will there be? And will we have the balance of power? Because the ideal situation for us is if we have about 50 MPs and we have the balance of power.
Yes.
To put now, Corbyn in.
That is obviously a strong possibility. And I can... I haven't made predictions for the election yet. I probably won't do that until between 1 and 2 weeks out. But I think it still looks like a hung parliament's a strong possibility at this point. Now, let's cast our minds forward and imagine that we do end up in that situation. The SNP's got 50 seats plus, and neither the Conservatives nor the Labour Party can form government without it. Because the Tories could end up a few seats short and the Lib Dems put them over or something like that. But let's imagine they end up with a little under 300 and they need the SNP. Either side would need the SNP to form government. Do you think Corbyn will accede to the request for the Section 30 order for a referendum next year? Do you think Boris would consider it if he's put on the spot?
Well, I'm not sure where Boris would be. If Boris lost the election, Boris wouldn't be leader anymore. So that's the first thing. So I don't think he'd be around. But Corbyn, I think the very fact that he's being equivocal about saying words to the extent of not in the first part of a Labour government, which is code for not until after the Holyrood 2021 elections.
Yes.
So it's his get up. But I think it's obvious that both parties would have no choice but to accede to it, because we're legislating for this stuff to happen now. We've set up a social justice commission, which I'm on. I've been appointed to it. And that social justice commission is about showing the prospectus we have for what kind of more equal Scotland we shall have, what is policy on welfare and wages, community development, all of those aspects of how do we tackle poverty and social inequality. We're giving a prospectus. When we report in the new year, we'll be giving what the independent Scotland will be like.
Right. And so that, I wanted to ask you about this, the Social Justice Commission. Yeah. So that's going to feed into SNP policy, isn't it?
It will be for the SNP, for party conference in the spring.
And how does that relate? I've got to raise this because it comes up a lot. Now I'm not a member of any party. I'm actually an independent, but this does come up a lot. The Growth Commission report. How does the Social Justice Commission? How will it relate to the Growth Commission report? and how will those things be balanced within the party?
Okay, a lot of nonsense has been said about the Growth and Cohesion Report. Mm. Firstly, that most people who comment on it haven't actually read it. Mm. That's the first thing. It is a 200-plus page economic document.
Yeah.
But essentially, it had 50 recommendations, 40 plus of which are perfectly non-controversial, because they're all the things that you require to have an independent country. Mm. And also some of the tactical things you might have, like a gender equality commission, things like that, having a banking clearing system and an independent currency.
Yep.
The controversial bit is how quickly we would go to an independent currency, and conference voted very decisively in spring last year to make that transition short.
Yes.
So we will be going for an independent currency quickly. That's the first thing. We will not be standing by the Bank of England's neoliberal prescription. So that's the first thing about the Growth Commission. Second thing about it is that actually, remember, it's research commissioned during 2017 and 2018. Stuff which didn't deal with Brexit, because we didn't know what Brexit was outcome was going to be, and which didn't deal with the climate emergency either, and also didn't deal with automation. The three biggest challenges economically were not in our supposed, in quotes, hand quotes, air quotes, economic document. So I'm more of the view that already, when we were publishing it and voting on it, the Growth Commission was already out of date and actually not relevant, because we haven't factored in the Brexit negative impact, if we do it. We haven't factored in the effect of automation, how that might impact on the job losses to come from the spread of automation of some of the people working now. Right, listen to this. If you're working in delivery or logistics, how likely is it your position will still exist? And that will create an issue about how to raise public funds and what kind of economic replacement you have for those sorts of jobs. So obviously the Green New Deal and the ideas and discussions around those things are crucial. You know, if we don't develop a renewables-based economy and therefore the prospect of new jobs, that's the first thing that needs to happen. So that needs to be factored in. So an economic forecast around what we mean by growth, well, growth can't be only defined by GDP. We're already moving to concepts of a well-being-based economy, which is moving away from GDP as the only identifier.
Right.
So the Social Justice Commission will, of course, be focused on that. You know, we're focusing on how to spend the wealth and how to redistribute it, and how communities need to be helped to do that, and what role the state should have in doing it. So we're talking about some of the socialist transitional demands, if you like, about how we should move away from this model of capitalism to a different model post-independence.
Yes. So with that, we can expect to see more of a radical perspective to the offer for independence next time, because we are looking at that, I suppose, especially if there's a referendum next year.
Well, it will be in the context of climate emergency too. You know, the whole requirement to move away from the carbon based economy. That means it's the just transition. It means all those posts in defence, carbon polluting industries, all those high technical skill jobs need to be transferred to renewables, energy systems, and all the construction, home insulation, all those industries which could be expanded. Now, of course, we're not the only party to talk about that, I get that, but the advantage we have is that the Scottish state plays a bigger role in the economy in our small country than the UK state does.
Yeah.
So that it has an impact that allows us to influence. We've already passed motions and policy to create a Scottish National Investment Bank. That came from the left's Scottish National Infrastructure Company to create a core projects standing workforce and standing planning and implementation body. We've already passed policy on that. So those are left-wing policies which we've won already, without being that well organised, to be dead honest. So the very fact that somebody like me is on the Social Justice Commission, there are others who share my view who are on it, gives you some indication that where that commission is going to report. I can't prejudge it, I can't say how we discuss these things, but obviously I would be very surprised if the recommendations weren't anything other than very radical, so that the offer we make to the Scottish people when the referendum comes, they will understand exactly how they will benefit from it.
I mean, I suppose I can't claim that I read the entire Growth Commission report. I did read a fair bit of it, And yeah, as you say, it was a lot of it was quite inoffensive and not controversial at all. But I suppose the point that I was stuck on, I think a lot of people were stuck on, were the debt figures and the conservative income figures, because of course we have this problem with JERS. We have to talk about JERS, as people keep saying. It's not providing us with an accurate summation of where we're at. And because of that, I suppose that those assumptions were taken on by the Growth Commission, and they said, well, we're going to have to go through this period of austerity to get our budget in shape. I'm from Clydebank, as I think I mentioned to you, and I don't think it's not going to be that much worse, is a message that I can sell on the doorsteps of Clydebank, if you like. They're going to want to know that it's going to be better. Now, I think that JERS has probably got a lot to answer for in that respect, and that it just consistently understates our true wealth.
Oh, I would agree with you that JERS doesn't reflect what the true wealth of the economy is. But I suppose you have to understand what the task of the previous commission was and who was on it. Obviously, it had lots of sections of business and industry, universities, some SNP politicians. It was supposed to have the STUC on board.
Right.
And had it had the STUC on board, and for some reason the communications between the two didn't work out properly, so they didn't participate, but they obviously probably didn't participate because many of them are pro-Labour and we're the SNP, so that is probably the reason why they didn't participate. But it was fully intended that the trade union should be a key part of developing that strategy. So it's pretty clear that it's been negatively affected by the lack of a trade union presence or left presence on the commission.
Right.
It was intended to have. So it's reflective of the, if you like, the narrow economic concerns of who was on the commission. That's not to say that they're all radical right wingers. They're not. Most of them are left wing social democrats who are in business circles or in industries and sections of industries. And they are obviously advocating for what will be the least damaging to their sections of industry. So they've gone from conservative assumptions precisely to try and keep a mainstream discussion around this. The audience isn't me and it isn't you.
No.
The audience of that document is people with, who were scared off last time by the apparent lack of economic prudence behind our offer. People who weren't convinced on pensions or weren't convinced that our money would be safe or our currency would be valuable enough. Those people who had those kind of very narrow financial economic concerns, that's who were the audience for that document. That's my theory about it.
Well,
it wasn't aimed at me.
No, I got that it certainly wasn't aimed at me. Because I do have a background in economics, I sort of know where it was coming from. And look, this is quite interesting. I was talking to an economist online the other day, but anyone who's been educated since the 80s in economics has got these ideas that are just wrong. I studied economics in the early 80s. When most of economic academia was still influenced by Keynes and the post-war consensus, and we've just been watching neoliberalism and going, but we always knew that was wrong. We knew that was wrong in 1935. That was thoroughly discredited.
Deficit reduction
in the Depression, and that's why we changed. But a group of people gradually got together and gradually were able to have more and more influence until they were able to take over mainstream economic academia in the 80s, and all the answers changed. If you did an exam, if you did Economics 101 in 1980 and you did it again in 1990, the answers were different. Because I did it just to check that I was correct in this theory. But so hopefully what the Social Justice Commission is going to do is balance out some of that.
Well, I should be clear, it's not necessarily intended to balance it out because it's not offering an economic perspective. Its task isn't to answer the Growth Commission. I mean, and also you need to be aware that the Growth Commission is a temporal piece of work for the SNP just now as it moves into this discussion about independence. It is not the perspective for policy for independence. It's not even the SNP's manifesto for independence, for economics for post-independence.
Yeah. So, and as you say, there's a fair bit that's actually changed since.
As it changed before we'd even published it. Mm. So I would say that clearly a perspective from the left around what the economic future is has to deal with the climate emergency, has to deal with automation, and it has to factor in Brexit, and I would add a fourth, which is factoring in more localized economy where social enterprise and community empowerment and control is a major element of how we design cities, towns and communities. That has to be the key way we deliver this stuff. But to me, it's a version of socialism. It's different from the statist top-down one that Jeremy Corbyn wants Westminster to be the arm to do it. Well, nah, I want to utterly revolutionise things, and that's the way we should be moving. The Social Justice Commission will talk about how well-being will be worked out, how we whether we have a citizen's income, these sorts of questions is the sort of questions it will deal with.
Hmm. Now, just before we go off the subject of Brexit, I've just been thinking, I want to very, very crudely paraphrase Yanis Varoufakis, because looking at his writing over the last few years, a lot of people bring up Greece when you talk about the European Union, especially a lot of people on the Lexit side, and we do have, I'm sure, some listeners who incline towards that point of view. So to very crudely paraphrase him, his position was if you're in, you wouldn't leave. But if you were out, you wouldn't join. Now, obviously that's two very different scenarios that Scotland could potentially face, an independent Scotland could potentially face. Have we remained, and we're just inheriting the membership and remaining in the EU, or have we gone through Brexit and we're thinking about reapplying? What would your inclination be in those circumstances? Would you support reapplying?
I would, and the reason why I would, and the reason why I probably moved to the position, I should explain. When Maastricht's treaty was signed, I actually went to demonstrations in Europe against what I saw as the bosses' Europe. I actually put hand up and wrote leaflets and drafted them, to say against the bosses' Europe for a workers' Europe, and that's still what I believe. Mm. But the bosses' Europe was made the bosses' Europe because of states like Britain being run by neoliberal capitalists.
British... Margaret Thatcher was at the forefront of that, wasn't she? She was the one who spread from here.
Well, she was the one who argued for the single European market, the single European Act in 1985. I remember travelling to France before that, and we used to get held up for 14 hours either side at Dover and Calais before you got across. Yeah. And if you carried goods, forget trying to bring in fresh flowers or fresh goods because they would get stuck
for
in
the trailer. I'm old enough to remember it too.
So people forget that that's how it used to be before the Channel Tunnel. We could go back to that. Now, if we're outside, then the obvious benefit of us is to reconnect back with our market and be Europeans again. Scots, young Scots especially, they want to be Europeans. They are Europeans. We are all Europeans. We're used to being able to visit Europe as our home territory, as a continent. And I think that's a good thing because that stops wars and negative nationalism and competition between the different countries. People underestimate the importance of that ultra, European-wide unity, even if it is on a capitalist basis. And this is the thing. If you're a socialist internationalist, you want to go beyond the existing internationalism, not break it down. You have to supersede it with something better. That means fighting from inside to create radical left-wing governments that will cooperate and transform their societies together. Yep. It's better if we as a working class across Europe do that in the same rhythms and pulses because we're responding to the same economic circumstances and events and institutions. It would be easier. If you want a progressive socialist solution to society and climate change, we need to do that as multinationally. That may be contradictory with the idea of Scottish independence, and if you then leave and then you join. Now, if we're outside when we become independent, then I'd be in favour of a referendum. So it's up to the people to rejoin. It's also up to the people whether we join Norway style, Canada style, or whether we're a full member or not. I'm personally easy. I don't have a preference either way. But as long as we're in some shape or form, I'm happy. I read Yanis Varoufakis's... Varoufakis.
Varoufakis, yes. Varoufakis. That's the easy one to get wrong.
Johnny Varoufakis. Yeah. I can't call that. But he's a great guy, and and that book is very Adults in the Room. If you've not read Adults in the Room, please read that, folks, if you listen to this. Excellent account of all the efforts that their government and him as the economics minister made to try to persuade the Europeans to do something that was even sensibly capitalist to save Greece, which they could have done. And it shows you just how much it's a political choice to inflict this nonsense. It's not economic inevitability. Yes. It's political choices that horrible, nasty, unaccountable bureaucrats in the centre of the apparatus made, but authorised by those neoliberal governments. It wasn't without political intervention that there's politics that decided to punish a left-wing government trying to break from neoliberalism. So if there's any hint that that is the kind of Europe we're joining, then that won't wash with our people and it won't wash with us. But I'm confident that I have faith in the people of Europe that there will be a shift because of the climate emergency back to the left, and I'm quite confident that we will have plenty of partners to join in that struggle to save our planet and our society.
Yes, yes. Well, I certainly hope so. And look, I haven't decided on a final position yet. It might be if we are taken out and we have to reapply, it might be easier to have a Norway style arrangement. But let's see how that pans out. Now, I do want to touch, we have been talking for a little while, but I do want to touch briefly on your role as a councillor in Glasgow. Now, there's been a few controversies with Glasgow. I mean, obviously, we know that the SNP didn't win an outright majority. It was about 50-50, wasn't it?
No, we won. No, we got, I think, about 40-odd% of the vote, something like that.
Right.
So we've got about 40-odd% of seats.
So now we have recently had a bit of a can we call it a scandal? There's been a bit of controversy on the council with the province. Now I know that you've been involved in dealing with that and cleaning up after that. Just tell me what your thinking was in terms of the look that it gave.
Well, it was pretty clear that, you know, there was a budget for this. There's a £5,000 budget for the Lord Provost and all the Baileys that work under her, the people who deputise for her. You know, when you're wearing the bat, when you're wearing the big bling sort of bracelet around your neck, and you've got the council vehicle that comes with you and the security guard that comes with you, you have to have a suit. So nothing wrong with the fact that she bought suits to do that official job, because it's the largest job.
It's not,
you know, people who have a thinking that it's jollies. No, it's four or five events every day, each of which you have to have a speech for, each of which you have to turn up looking good. So I don't knock the idea that you should buy some suits, but I don't think if you're on a salary as much as she was, which is about £40,000, something like that, which is nearly three times what I'm earning as a standard councillor, I think you should buy your own undergarments and your own shoes.
Yeah. Seems like a fair enough request.
Yeah, because the rest of us have to. And that thing is, as you said to me earlier, does it pass the pub test? Well, in our case, did it pass the community test when people were asking us about it? And one of the things that when we took over was that we were going to be different from Labour.
Yeah.
We were going to be the massive reform, root and branch reform of the council, changing the relationship of that bureaucracy facing the working class people, trying to equalise more the relationship between them and treat customers with some respect, you know, as constituents and service users. And we've mostly succeeded in doing that because we've come to it as humble people trying to change things. That behaviour and that action, while it was within the rules, in my view, politically breached our thinking on this. And to have backed her to continue in the post, I'd have had to agree with that conduct as right, even though it was within the rules.
Yes.
I think it wasn't within political rules. And I think if we had voted to defend her on that one, it would have just meant that we were the same as old Labour we were replacing, that politicians all the same, they were eating from the same trough, feathering their own nest. Now, of course, that's not what she was trying to do, but I think she was badly advised. And it is partly unfair because Labour men who have been provost bought just as many suits as she did. Maybe they bought fewer shoes, but they bought suits too and spent the whole budget, you know, £5,000 each year. So, you know, the hypocrites who were attacking her for that, they're hypocrites. But it was the wrong decision she made where she made claims. And we tried very hard within the group to persuade her to take action, which she could have done. And if she had done previously, I think she might not have had to resign. But when it came to it, we felt that it was not justifiable. So it was actually we who voted to ask her to resign.
I see. So, I mean, and you allude to, obviously, the history of abuse by the Labour Party, which now, I mean, I come from one of the safest Labour seats in Scotland. Historically, it's not anymore, but it was. And we had a Labour council also for, you know, ever since anyone can remember. And these sorts of things were quite commonplace. And we did see a lot of cronyism, a lot of nepotism.
Those days are over.
Well, yeah, certainly for the Labour Party they are. As long as we don't find a new, you know, we find people that gravitate now towards the party that's in power. But I do want to just touch on one other thing that's a historical issue and just get maybe an update from you, which is that when when we had the last council elections, Labour lost control. We subsequently learned that they were systematically underpaying female workers for years upon years. How's that progressing now? Are we almost getting through that?
We are. Well, obviously, people have already received their first payment, and many of them have gone on holidays, bought houses, all the things they couldn't do all these years. It's been brilliant to get brilliant letters from women who've got their pay and have been able to, some of them retire gracefully and very happily, some of them continue working, whatever their choice has been. But it's been great to see them get their justice. And obviously they'll get their second payment now in December, so it'll be another Christmas payment. So it's been brilliant to be part of a decision. And actually, just last night at the Herald's Scotland's Politician of the Year Awards, Nicola Sturgeon, of course, won the Politician of the Year for all the brilliant things she'd done, but actually the local Politician of the Year was Susan Aitken, the council leader, and it was in recognition for her leadership and, you know, forthrightness in sorting Labour's mess out over the equal pay. Because for 10 years, Labour councillors basically said, talk to the hand, talk to the lawyers, we're not listening. And they refused for 10 years to negotiate with the trade unions affiliated to their party. For 10 years, they refused to negotiate about this, saying, oh, we've settled the pay bargaining system years ago, that's fine, we've done that, done deal. The women are, what, they're talking nonsense, we're not going to listen to them. And for basically, the women in those two unions, in particular the GMB, had to campaign against their own union to get them to take action. And then finally they did, but they only did so when we were in administration. Funnily enough, they didn't go on strike when Labour were in office. And then the very same Labour councillors who denied those women their justice for all those years turned up on demos with those women in George Square against our administration when we were sorting it out. Damn cheek of it. So, but I'm proud of, that's the best thing that we have done, is settled that. Even though it's been very expensive, it's £500 million worth of settlement, but it's right, it's just justice. And we've had to essentially mortgage the arts estate, you know, the
I was going to ask how's Glasgow Court.
Well, we've effectively taken out a loan against that. We still own all those assets, but obviously if we don't pay the loan, then we could lose that. But I think it's manageable. It's a bold way of financing it, but it was the only way, effectively, as a sort of bond to pay this off over a number of years. I think over two or three decades, I think it's. So it's expensive, but it's the only way we could do it without damage to frontline services, without making cuts, and in a way that actually delivered the justice quickly.
Well, yeah, clearly had to be done. I suppose for those people who have been affected, it's really been like a form of enforced savings, which they're now finally getting to realise and spend some of it.
And that, of course, where are they spending it? They're spending it within the Scottish economy, boosting Glasgow's. And also, think of all the things it's done to help their families and everything. It will have done a lot of good for them and their families and for the economy. So we win all ways around. So.
Mm. Well, it's great to finish a political interview on a little bit of good news for once. So hopefully, and I guess everyone's who's been affected knows about it now. Or is it, are we still looking for anyone?
Not as far as I know, but as I'm not dealing with this on day to day.
Right. Well, if you think you were affected and you haven't heard anything about it yet, do get in touch. But that's a fine thing that it's finally being dealt with. And I guess these things are just institutional, but it's nice to know that they are eventually recognised and people are paid what's owed to them.
Well, put it this way: when we saw that Labour had spent £2 million plus in legally fighting them against them in the courts, that was the moment when we made our decision to stop that nonsense, stop taking it through the courts. And say, this is just not right. When we have to make hard decisions about saving this or saving that, and you know, saving budgets here and there, there's no way I can justify spending £2.5 million more to stop women getting pay that's less.
Yes.
Which is what Labour did.
Which is essentially just deferring the day when the reckoning eventually comes, and you've got to pay for it anyway. So. Oh well. Now, I think we've covered quite a lot of ground. Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about?
We've probably gone on for long enough, but I think the thing to look out for is that we finally launched Glasgow City Council's historical investigation and inquiry into the origins of slavery money in our city. Dr. Stephen Mullen has been employed as of October to as of November, I should say, to compile an investigation and a report into the origins of the money that built city chambers and into all our Lord Provosts in the past to see what our slavery legacy and connection is as a city. This report is due to be delivered by next year's Black History Month in October, and we will present some findings. I've been in charge with a review committee to look into that paper when it's published, but also to convene a sort of committee dealing with the public to look at interested parties who are interested to what our response should be on things like statues, squares, streets that are named after slave owners, what we should do about those things. So we're engaging the public, and I'll be calling meetings in the new year.
It's a fascinating subject. Perhaps we can speak again on that specifically. That would be fantastic. Well, Councillor Graham Campbell, thanks for joining us on Ungagged.
You're welcome. Good night.